studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, Jenny Julander and Ashley Miller of Breathe Utah join us in the first part of the show. Breathe Utah is a nonprofit that advocates policies and measures that support clean air. Among other things, they have an event coming up this Earth Day. They'll provide the details, along with a summary of some air-related bills that passed or didn't pass out of this latest state legislature session.
That's right. Then in the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with Scott Parkin, the climate campaign director of the Rainforest Action Network, about the latest on the Keystone XL pipeline.
Is that still around?
It's back.
And it's done.
We've all heard that Trump has given it the green light, but what does that mean for the future of the project?
Right.
Is it a done deal? What happens next? So Scott will be here to talk us through all of that.
Good. All of that and maybe some news on the clean power plant. Which
That's
we
right.
actually we might cover with Breathe Utah.
That's
one of
right.
The issues.
Might get their input,
what,
too.
What's happening there? And that's going to happen today, what the president plans to do to that plan. You can, of course, join us, but although we don't take phone calls, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hi, this is The Bruce, Dumpster Guardian at Recycle Utah. Did you know Americans demolish nearly 250 homes each year? Instead of demolishing a building, contact the Reuse People of America to deconstruct the building for you and donate the salvage materials to Recycle Utah.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in studio for the first part of the show are a couple representatives from Breathe Utah. They're a nonprofit that advocates, like I say, policies, measures, initiatives, programs in support of clean air for all Utahns. Not just a few of us that actually care about that, but everybody. And joining us specifically is Jenny Julander and Ashley Miller. Jenny Julander is a staff member, a volunteer with Breathe Utah, right? And Ashley Miller is the program and policy director with Breathe Utah. Thanks again for coming in this morning. First of all, you have an event. Let's get right to the shameless plug. You have an event coming up this Earth Day. Give us the details on it and how people can attend.
Okay, so the Earth Day event is coming up on April 22nd at the Utah Valley Convention Center in Provo. It will be from 2 to 5 in the afternoon, and it's going to be to raise awareness for clean air initiatives. It's actually kind of a fun event because it's a masquerade, so it's going to be like party for clean air, you know.
I like it.
Everyone who buys a ticket also gets a free copy of my new novel called Green Lady, so you can see the alignment there with Earth Day. It's
what?
Kind of a fun idea.
Yeah, we didn't know about this before the show.
Breaking news, Jenny. You've written a novel.
Yes.
About what that has air, clean air related to it?
It's actually, it's a fantasy novel, but it goes into the whole idea of like you know, powers that come from the earth and keeping the forest clean.
Wow.
All right. I like that. All right, so bonus.
So that's what you get.
Yes.
If you attend this event, signed copy.
You get a discount on a signed copy or a free electronic copy with your ticket.
Okay. All right. So, again, that's down in Provo.
Yes.
And what can I expect to see when I'm there?
So we're going to have a lot of businesses there. Breathe Utah will be present to speak about some clean air tips that people might not know just off the top of their head. And they'll also be present throughout the event if people have questions. And then we also have a few partners, such as the Natural History Museum and Red Butte Gardens, who are contributing, and they will also be present present to speak with people. We're also giving out prizes for visiting everybody's booth who's going to be there. So we have some great prizes from some of our partners. And there's also a dance-off. If you can get me to dance with you on the floor, then you enter to win a free signed copy of the book. My friends talked me into that.
All right.
I like it.
And we'll have live music from the Heber Valley Orchestra. We're going to have a cello quartet playing.
So oh, very
it's
cool.
It's going to be a really nice atmosphere.
All right.
And tell us about, do you need to register for this event, buy your ticket in advance?
Yes, you can register on Eventbrite. And it's called the Earth Day Masquerade Party.
Earth Day Masquerade Party. Okay. And again, when does it start?
This starts on April 22nd at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
2 in the afternoon.
Yes.
Until
5 o'clock.
Mark? Until you're done dancing? All right.
Until you're done dancing.
Or all the books
until
are
the
gone.
Night is over.
Okay. But most importantly, there's a lot of information, a lot of awareness to become plugged in on about air quality, air pollution, the impacts thereof to us and the environment.
Yes.
Right? That's the biggest thing. The
Absolutely.
Biggest takeaway there. Okay. So let's segue from that to, well, air quality down in the Salt Lake Valley. Ashley or Jenny, I mean, well, Jenny, you live in Heber.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. I want to get to that in a minute because Heber is growing, is undergoing a lot of growth, and they're in a valley, and they may start to see some impacts from air qualities and inversions. We'll get to that, get to you in a minute. But I want to start down at the bigger issue is Salt Lake Valley, Salt Lake City area. Jenny, Ashley, you kind of followed the latest legislative session, some of the House bills, Senate bills, with respect to air quality. How did they do overall? Were there some thumbs up, more thumbs down in some of the bills that were passed or didn't get passed?
Well, there were definitely a lot of positive things that came out of this legislative session that we always like to focus on the positive. First and foremost, the Division of Air Quality puts in a request for funding each session. Mm-hmm. And this year, to our surprise, they were almost entirely funded. I think they fell short only about $50,000. So that what they'll do with that money is expand and improve the monitoring system. Most of the monitors we have around the state are beyond their useful life, and we don't have backups on the shelf. So when those monitors go out, the Division of Air Quality loses weeks of data until they can get someone out there to fix those monitors. So this money will actually go to getting some new monitors, expanding into areas that are now required by federal standards to be monitored. We also have funded $200,000. The request was for $250,000, but for research out in the Uinta Basin, which includes an infrared camera device to detect methane leaks from oil and gas extraction, which is huge because out in the Uinta Basin, we have this really terrible ozone problem in the wintertime, which is very odd because ozone is typically a summertime pollutant.
Sure.
So that's really, really, really important. Went the day before the last day of the session in the afternoon, we saw that appropriation requests were met, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I must have read the report 10 times to say,
am I sure
I'm reading this the right? This says funded. Is it supposed to say not funded? So we were really, really happy about that.
So they requested $250,000. They got $200,000.
They got $200,000, and that was just for the research. The monitoring, I think it was $1.1 million and $150,000 ongoing or something like that, which... Let me just add that isn't enough money for the Division of Air Quality to do their job, but it is what was budgeted for in the governor's budget. And so to get that money, that part at least fully funded, that's a huge win. I would say if nothing else happened in the legislative session, big win for air quality.
Well, that'll be exciting to see what comes from that and to see the results from all of that research and monitoring.
Okay, that's encouraging. Here's another House Bill 183 that I found interesting, emissions settlement amendments. It says it creates a process, and this passed apparently, this creates a process to spend the approximately $35 million that Utah will receive as part of its settlement with Volkswagen.
Yeah, this is great. Wow. So a part of the Volkswagen settlement, like written into the settlement agreement, each state that is awarded money from that, and Utah's getting a considerable amount from that, has to go through a very rigorous process on deciding how that money will be spent. And it's actually really great. The whole process includes a public process. So ideas will be kind of drummed up about what to spend this money on, and then it has to be vetted by the public. And the public has an opportunity to weigh in. And then, you know, depending on what comes out of that process, we have these new programs and initiatives that will combat diesel emissions.
Okay, so I was just going to ask, it's specifically going to be focused on diesel emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the timeline for this? When do we start to expect to see those opportunities for comment and involvement coming out?
Soon. This summer, actually, they'll begin the process of getting these ideas on the table, putting them out to the public, and it'll be an ongoing process. But again, there will be plenty of notice, and Breathe Utah will be covering that like crazy. So you can always check our website and join our mailing list and get updates on when the opportunity is for public comment.
That's a huge amount of money. That says
it's
the Division of Air Quality will administer those funds, $35 million. Do you think any of that could go to local nonprofits who focus on air quality?
Probably
advocacy?
Not. It's not
for grants or anything like
that. No, it's not for grants. It's more like actual tangible things like, you know, maybe an opportunity to change out dirty diesel school buses with cleaner burning fuel, you know, addressing
diesel powered generators
exactly.
with natural gas powered generators. Okay. So
stuff like that.
No, so you're saying it's diesel
focused. So measurable,
focused.
Tangible.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Monitoring and enforcement, perhaps?
I'm not 100% certain on that, but I think it's more like replacing old, outdated equipment that can be replaced with much newer technology.
Still, that's a $35 million windfall.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Volkswagen got hammered on that.
Well, they did a terrible thing.
As they should.
But, if that $35 million just went to Utah, what is California getting? It must be over $1 billion, the total fee that Volkswagen is.
We'll
paying.
Look that one up. We'll get our research team on that.
50
and get
times
back
35,
to you
the, 1.5 billion.
So those were a couple of the big wins. There was also one bill that we had talked about during the session, Chris and I, with another guest, and this had to do with wood fires, with burning of wood fires for the purposes of making food. Talk to us a little bit about this. Where does this bill stand now?
So this bill is currently still on Governor Herbert's desk, and he is going to decide either to veto the bill, which we're really hoping for, or to sign it into law. This bill is really bad for our air quality, and I'll tell you why. It's not that groups like Breathe Utah and other advocates are saying, you know, we don't want you as just, you know, Susie homeowner, and we don't want you guys barbecuing in your backyard. That's not what this is about. In the wintertime, backyard barbecuing probably isn't a major source of air pollution contributing to our airshed. However, if this is codified into law, right now it's not currently regulated. The only thing that is a part of the burn restriction is quote unquote comfort heating, burning for comfort heating. So by definition alone, cooking food does not fall in there. There's no written in rule exemption right now. So this would actually create an exemption for whatever your heart desires cooking food. That can be a giant open fire pit in your backyard with a bag of marshmallows and a hot dog on a stick.
Mm-hmm.
It can be smoking a super fatty brisket for 12 hours on a red air day when you can't even see your hand in front of your face. And what's really damaging about this bill is it's not limited to residential. It's expanded to just all cooking, which includes commercial. So it could have a negative effect on the regulations that are already in place for commercial, like businesses like wood-fired pizza and smokehouses. They have pollution control equipment installed to lower their impact. This bill could do away with that. It could be a state law coming in and saying, well, you know, that piece of equipment's too expensive for me to operate anymore. I'm just going to get rid of it. So this is really damaging. And to remove the authority from the Division of Air Quality prematurely and say, hey, you know, we need to meet federal air quality standards, but we cannot look at any type of emissions coming from cooking food. That is really, really damaging. And I do feel like Governor Herbert knows that. The Air Quality Board wrote him a veto request letter, which is pretty unprecedented. I don't think they've ever done something like that in the past. But it really ties their hands of developing good data-driven rules that can address this in the future. You know, our population is expected to double by 2050, and we're just on the move. And what once might not have been a big deal, like backyard barbecuing, it could become a significant source of air pollution. And if we can't ever address that, that's really, really dangerous. We need to be able to look at everything.
And it seems like one of the problems with this bill, again, it's not cooking for, you know, subsistence if you have no other way. It's, you know, as you said, you can have a giant raging bonfire and a hot dog and a stick over it. And
on a red day.
On a red day.
I mean, it's one thing to have it on a green day, let's say.
Right.
But this doesn't preclude you from, say, it's a red day. You can still have your bonfire.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understand right, you could have a fire in your fireplace, too, as long as you're saying, I'm cooking a hot dog.
I have a kettle of water on there. I'm going to make tea.
Right.
You know, that's food.
Okay.
So how did this bill, it seems so crazy, so how did this originate? Tell us where it got started.
Well, this bill was brought to the legislature by Traeger Grills, a local company that actually came here from Oregon. Great company, by the way. You know, nothing against Traeger Grills. I hear if you eat a tri-tip that was cooked on a Traeger grill, if you're a vegan, you'll become a meat eater like immediately. But you know, unfortunately, what they're saying makes sense. We'll give them some credit. People are out there spending money on their grills, and they are expensive and they're high end. And they say, well, you know, what about in the wintertime? What about Super Bowl Sunday? I love to bring this up because Super Bowl Sunday is dead smack in inversion season. And is this what this is about? You know, I got to have my Super Bowl party. I got to smoke my brisket. I got to grill up for 20 people. My neighbor Gus has a heart condition. He might die, but whatever. I'm having a party. So their concern is the customers come to them and say, you know, I want to invest in this grill, but is the state going to tell me, you know, I can't use this for 20 days out of the year? It has a big impact. And what our messaging is to that is, you know, we all need to take responsibility for our air pollution. We have geographic challenges. It's not like we're extra heavy duty polluters. We just have to step up, be the Utahns that we all say we are. You know, we have these great values, and we need to say, you know what, I'm going to refrain from that Super Bowl Sunday party or my Tuesday night grill out with my boys or whatever it is, you know, and say this could have a major impact on my immediate neighbors. You know, not to mention my own family.
And talk about that a little bit. We haven't really talked about some of those health impacts of pollution. That's really the driving force. It's not about just the valley looking cloudy, right? It's about how that impacts our personal health.
Sensitive groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that you brought up sensitive groups, because to be quite honest, a sensitive group is over half the population in Salt Lake County alone. And honestly, it can be even way more than that. If you have allergies, you fall in the sensitive group. If you're a pregnant woman, sensitive group. Elderly,
asthma.
People with pre-existing conditions like asthma. You know, the data is out there just how terrible air pollution is on babies developing, on elderly people, just on everybody. It's not just one group of people.
Moms and future moms.
Right, exactly. You know, there's studies out there that say, oh, don't get pregnant during inversion season. Or, you know, I mean, how scary is that? Especially in an area where we, you know, really have large families and, you know. But the data's out there. Emergency room visits go up for asthma. Cardiovascular issues, heart attacks. I mean, we know that on days when our air pollution is elevated, our hospital visits go up significantly.
All right. we only got a few more minutes left. But to summarize it, that's House Bill 65, mm-hmm. Air Conservation Act Amendments. You're saying that the Department of Air Quality has logged in, sent a letter to the governor requesting this bill be vetoed. Very unusual.
The Air Quality Board.
Mm-hmm. All right. The Air Quality Board, not Department of Air Quality.
Yeah.
All right.
They can't. Otherwise, they probably would.
Okay. But still, very unusual for them to do that. The governor could make a decision today.
It could be any minute. That.
So if you want to email them, you can still email mm-hmm. them about House Bill 65.
Yep. Ask for a veto of House Bill 65.
Okay. How many bad air days was there during the state legislature? You know, we know that a bad air day, phone calls go up to legislators. How was the air quality this winter down there?
You know, we didn't see a too terrible season, but there was a period right in the middle of legislative session where we had bad air and the air got increasingly worse because we didn't see any storm patterns coming through right towards the beginning. It was actually a day when I was testifying against House Bill 65. It was like, hey, guys, look outside. Okay. You know, we need to think about these things.
A visual.
Yeah. I mean, better visual than that beautiful Capitol complex and you can't even see downtown? It's pretty alarming. You know, and then, of course, towards the end of legislative session, it's always beautiful. We get those warm, clear, you know, early spring days and people kind of forget.
But
our memories are short in that way.
Mm-hmm. But overall, would you say that the trend with our state legislature is in the right direction with respect to air quality measures and programs or not so much?
I think so. There's a wonderful group, the Bipartisan Clean Air Caucus.
Okay.
It's, you know, representatives and senators from both parties, Republicans and Democrats alike. I think that sometimes we wonder, you know, are these people against air quality? You know, we look at our state lawmakers and wonder what they're thinking when they vote a certain way. But there is a large group up there that works really hard. They work with the advocates. They work with the Division of Air Quality. You know, they propose really great legislation and a lot of it gets pushed through. And then we had some really great bills that were up there that didn't quite make it, like the emissions testing amendments that would expand to require counties to include diesel cars. And that got hung up on the last day of the session. It wouldn't get prioritized because the majority whip is from Utah County and there were some issues down there. And so that was a loss. It was a significant loss. That was a great bill. Well constructed. Would have seen measurable difference. 170 tons a year that would save just from Utah County alone. So sometimes we wonder, you know, what are you guys thinking?
Yeah.
And so that's where we come in and say, what were you thinking? Why were you thinking that way? And let's change it.
Okay.
Let's work on the bill for next year.
And so just as we wrap up here, you guys obviously have a variety of programs of ways to get involved. Listeners can go to your website to find all that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. BreatheUtah.org. If you have kids that are in schools and you want Breathe Utah to come out and do a school presentation and talk about all things air quality in their school, we have a place on our webpage where you can put in a request and we'll get in contact with your school and get that set up. We also go to a lot of businesses and community councils and talk about the things that families can do. You know, there's a lot of small behavioral changes that we can make as individuals that don't really, you know, they're not too burdensome on us. Might not even feel a difference, but they will have a significant impact on air quality. And that's what we like to, our messaging to go in that direction.
Right. Collective impact
mm-hmm.
and tragedy of the commons.
Yeah. Well,
collective impact makes a difference there. All right.
Well, fantastic.
Last word to Jenny, real quick again,
that's right.
That event.
Yes, and if you want a quick, easy way to make a difference and contribute to Breathe Utah's ability to visit the schools, actually the ticket proceeds from our Earth Day event are going to go toward Breathe Utah. You get a free copy of my novel if you buy a ticket. And also we're having a silent auction at the event that will raise money for Breathe Utah.
All right. And again, that's on Earth Day?
Yes, Earth 22nd. Day, April 22nd.
All right. Go to breatheutah.org for more information about that and everything that Breathe Utah does. Ashley Miller and Jenny Julander, thank you again for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
We'll have you back with some more updates. All right, let's take a quick break. Our next guest is already queued up.
That's right.
Scott Parkin.
We will be speaking with Scott Parkin from the Rainforest Action Network about the latest on the Keystone XL pipeline.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Gabriel Melendez, personal banker at U.S. Bank in Park City and sponsor of the Minor Nation Report on KPCW. We offer financial and retirement planning, IRAs, and retirement services, along with investing and wealth management. U.S. Bank is located on the corner of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive. usbank.com or 647-3726.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
That's right, right across the board. And joining us for the second half of the show is Scott Parkin. He's the Climate Campaign Director of the Rainforest Action Network. And he's here to fill us in on the latest on the Keystone XL pipeline. So, Scott, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So before we dig too deep into the Keystone XL pipeline, tell us a little bit about your role. Yeah, that was a pun intended. Tell us a little bit about your role at the Rainforest Action Network.
Yeah, Rainforest Action Network is an environmental nonprofit that does national and international work on climate change and on rainforests. My role is I'm the director of the Climate and Energy Program. And so I direct a team which puts pressure on a variety of corporate and political targets to get them to being bad actors on climate and energy issues. Most of our work for the last 15 years or so has been putting pressure on Wall Street banks, which are funding those environmental bad actors. And so over the years, we've fought campaigns trying to get banks to stop funding mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. We actually ran a pretty hard campaign 2 or 3 years ago, excuse me, 3 years ago on the Keystone Pipeline. Most recently, we ran a campaign trying to get the Obama administration to end the federal fuel leasing program. So now that Keystone has come back up, we have kind of reset our sights on that, and it began a new campaign to put pressure on banks which are funding TransCanada, which is the parent company of Keystone XL.
So is this a move, this sort of green lighting by Trump of the Keystone XL pipeline? Was this something you were expecting, or were you surprised to see this?
No, we were totally expecting this. From Election Day, we knew it was a campaign promise, and we knew that he was going to go for it. And then, you know, the week after his inauguration, he signed an executive order to kind of push forward a fast-track process to approve both Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline.
And so he basically invited TransCanada to reapply for the permit. And if I understand, the State Department approved that permit last week?
Yeah, on Friday.
Friday.
Yes.
So, like Nell said, the project has been green-lighted then, in a sense. It's going to move forward. The final leg of its construction will move forward.
Yes. The State Department approved the permit, one which we had been fought for years under both the Bush and Obama administrations, one that the President Obama actually ended up rejecting in November of 2015. We like to call it a zombie pipeline. The Trump administration has brought it back once again, and now there's federal approval to build a pipeline that would run from Alberta down to Cushing, Oklahoma, I believe, and then there are still a number of places where that we're going to be challenging the pipeline, which includes like the route through Nebraska has not been settled. There's also where it's going to cross different indigenous territories in Montana and South Dakota and other places. And then there's just going to be like general court, federal court suits coming up from like other environmental groups. And then at Rainforest Action Network, we're going to be challenging the financing of it.
So that's, talk a little bit about that. That's an angle that we don't hear about as frequently. What angle is the Rainforest Action Network taking on this?
Yeah, we're going to basically going to be following the money. There's about a $5 billion credit, which was given to TransCanada in December, coincidentally around the same time in which they were reapplying for their permit for Keystone. There are 21 banks on that credit. The lead banks are J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of Montreal, but it's a long laundry list of financial sort of bad actors, in my opinion, from Europe, Canada, the United States. And then three of the banks actually on the loan are three of the banks which were took a good amount of heat through Dakota Access. That's Citibank, Wells Fargo, and TD or Toronto Dominion Bank. And so, you know, oil companies and pipeline companies need large amounts of cash pretty quick to be able to build the pipeline and get the operations going. And so they look to Wall Street, they look to banks in Europe and Canada and other parts of the world to basically fund this. And so what these banks have done is given them essentially like a $5 billion credit card to engage in this project.
Yeah, let's talk about the project itself. As you said, it's a portion of the pipeline has already been built. Because the part that comes runs from, I think it's actually Steel City, Nebraska, down to the Gulf Coast, Nederland, Houston area, that has already been constructed. That was constructed years ago because it didn't require State Department approval. It was an internal pipeline. The EPA approved it. This is the remaining portion, like you say, that starts first up in Hardisty, Canada, then travels through portions of Montana, South Dakota and Nebraska. The sand hills of Nebraska, I think, is kind of the area you mentioned is potentially in play as far as its environmental impacts. Its route hasn't been finalized. Right. So this is the remaining portion of the pipeline that TransCanada wants to construct. And I believe it's designed to carry 750,000 barrels of oil a day once up and running from the tar sands area in Canada, ultimately down to Houston or other refineries in the central part of the U.S. So it's this last section that is, I'll use the word again, in play with respect to whether or not it would be built and the challenges you could put up to that construction, correct?
Yeah. We'd like to call that the northern leg. It was the southern leg that was built. It was in 2012, 2013.
Where
the southern leg was built. The Obama administration approved that. And then it is the northern leg, which was actually had been in play from the beginning when environmental groups decided to put pressure on the State Department about the border crossing. And so we're going to see like a myriad of fronts kind of taken on the northern leg, whether it's around the route in Nebraska, whether it's in court, whether it's with the banks financing it. But it will be a probably long, hard, long fought campaign,
right?
Challenging the whether this is going to happen or not.
Okay.
One piece of that long fight that was interesting to me was that they'll need to get they'll need to work with local zoning and local regulations, and so they'll even need permits for things like use of local roads for construction equipment. You know, it gets down to this incredible level of detail, and I guess at every step that's a potential hurdle, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's points of intervention along the pipeline approval process. They've now approved it at the federal level. They have it approved at some state levels, but we're going to be fighting at state, municipal, county, what have you, as well as with the private sector.
Right. So I have to ask, you know, if you could make a guess, look into your crystal ball, how long do you think that getting all of these approvals will take? I mean, is this something that's going to hold this project up for months, years?
I mean, it depends on how hard we fight it. I've heard estimates of at least a year before, if they're able to get all of their approval, all their permit approval, they are able to continue with their funding, that sort of thing, then at least a year before oil is flowing. But we expect to kind of push back on that pretty hard and prevent that from happening. And I know that people on the ground in Nebraska are mobilizing to fight it. I know people on the ground in South Dakota are preparing to fight it.
Yeah, and here's another myth. Nell and I have been covering this story since what? Well, since it started, 08,
yeah, years,
right?
Yeah.
And maybe before that. So one of the things we constantly try to remind our listeners is this idea of how many jobs are going to be created. This administration talks about tens of thousands of jobs, et cetera, you know, construction jobs, good-paying jobs. Well, here's the reality that I actually know someone who's in the pipeline construction business, and he says that on any given day, this pipeline isn't from a technical level. It's not complicated to install pipeline. There are companies who this is all they do is build pipelines, so they're very efficient at it. He says that maybe on any given day, 150 people might be working on this pipeline, whose job it is to wake up in the morning and go work on this pipe, dig the trenches, lay the pipe, do the welding, the clearing and grubbing, the surveying, the revegetation, the full gamut. And then another support group back in the office, maybe 150 people full time. But what this administration does is account for everybody on a secondary and tertiary level who assist in this. So the waitress that pours the cup of coffee for the two guys, you know, who work on the pipeline is counted as a job.
Even on a temporary basis.
Yes,
so
temporary. So now everyone in that cafe is included in as a, you know, job creator that this pipeline does. And the pipeline is a moving traveling show. So it visits one city for a week or two, and then it moves on to the next. So I just it's important that this fallacy that tens of thousands of jobs will be created is just, well, it's just that. It's a fallacy. You want to? Sorry, Scott.
I totally agree.
Okay.
there was actually an article I saw last week that, as far as like you said, that'll be like those folks who have a secondary and tertiary connection to the pipeline are considered to be jobs.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that's only temporary. That's for a year. Let's say for a year and a half, however long it takes them to build the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a study last week or an article last week that said that there's probably going to be roughly like 35 permanent jobs from the Keystone Pipeline, mm-hmm. not tens of thousands.
Yeah. Once it's up and running, it doesn't take a lot to do the oversight, operation,
yeah.
maintenance of it, monitoring of it. A lot of it is done electronically, remotely, et cetera. So yeah, that's the other issue is that it's not a big employer once it's up and running. So
right.
Okay. So hey, we're speaking with Scott Park, and he's with the Rainforest Action Network. We're talking about the Keystone XL pipeline and its recent green lighting by this administration for its the construction of the northern leg of the pipeline. Scott, you mentioned at the beginning that one of the goals of the Rainforest Action Network is to put pressure on Wall Street banks and businesses. Give us some companies that do right, that you like, you know, that you've been able to work with and have a good environmental stewardship in mind on Wall Street.
On Wall Street?
Yeah.
I never want to, well, I'll just put it out there just overall. Overall caveat is I never really want to praise Wall Street banks too much.
Right.
You know, they're huge multi-billion-dollar, you know, diversified companies where maybe they're doing something right on coal, or they're doing something right on, you know, not funding armed shipments to the Ukraine or something like that. But then they're also also playing in other areas where they're doing bad things. Maybe they're funding private prisons or something like that.
Sure.
What I will say is that we've been running campaigns on banks since 2000. In 2015, we'd run campaigns on banks around coal mining and mountaintop removal coal mining for about 7 years. And so what we saw in 2015, right before the Paris climate talks, is that we saw over 20 banks from around the world basically pledge to kind of phase out of the coal mining sector. And so I actually feel like that was a step in the right direction. I would say that was a sector-wide step. And banks, you know, big banks on Wall Street, Citibank, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, all like put out policies to kind of put them, take themselves out of coal mining, as well as like European banks, Japanese banks, et cetera. And so that is one, you know, good thing I can say, good step I can say about as far as like Wall Street goes. I would also say that Wall Street, as far as climate goes, is much more progressive than, for example, the current administration. Mm-hmm. And so when we're communicating with the banks there, at one point when we first started these campaigns in the early 2000s, they were climate deniers along with the rest of the conservative establishment. And I would say through years, decades even, of like environmental advocacy, that we have like pushed the banks to, you know, accept climate change. I would say that, you know, Mother Nature doing things like flooding Wall Street during Hurricane Sandy was another step in that way. But there's actually a pretty powerful movement in communities all across North America and around the world, which is like sort of kind of contributing to Wall Street opening its eyes as far as like the realities of climate change and fossil fuels. That being said, they are still some of the biggest funders of the oil industry, of the gas industry. There's a huge build out of natural gas export going on the Gulf Coast. All kinds of banks are involved in that. Banks were, you know, big players in the Dakota Access Pipeline. There's a number of other pipelines being built or under consideration right now, and Wall Street banks are engaged with the private companies, which are pushing that all the time. So while I feel like we do make progress, I usually restrain my praise for them a little bit.
Sure.
But I will say that the phase out, sector-wide phase out that we saw around coal mining was a pretty important step, and so I will give them credit where some credit's due.
Now, I cringe even to ask this, but with some of the policies that we're just hearing about in the past few days, you know, from this current administration with relation to coal, do you expect those policies to change back, or do you think that they were made for economic reasons, and so the current policy is maybe irrelevant is too strong of a word, but it is not going to convince anybody to change their mind?
I mean, I'll throw out a couple of things. I definitely think there were economic factors. I think the price of gas, the sort of collapse of coal in the United States, we've still been seeing a boom in coal plant construction in other parts of the world, China, India, Turkey, Vietnam, places like that. But I also think that there's also like this sort of, there was an anti-coal movement. There's still an anti-coal movement, which I feel like has contributed to the banks like sort of kind of coming around to this, or a climate movement, which has contributed to the banks coming around this. But even like the really sort of arch conservative CEO, coal CEO, Robert Murray this week said that, you know, coal jobs aren't going to come back in the United States. Like Trump, that was a campaign position for the Trump campaign. And even though I think today he's actually signing an executive order to try and roll back the Clean Power Plant,
right,
and he's going to end the coal moratorium. I mean, he can open it up, but I think the reality is that coal has been in decline in this country for a couple of decades, definitely in like places like Central Appalachia. Peak coal happened like probably in the 70s.
Yeah,
and so
I'm sorry.
So, I mean, it's almost like political fantasy that he's somehow going to spark some sort of return to the golden heyday of coal mining in this country.
I love that phrase, political fantasy.
There's no shortage.
I mean,
that
this administration seems to operate in that
It's a through the looking glass world they live in. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Bob Murray, because I have a quote from him that kind of supports what you said. He's a coal executive, and this is what he told The Guardian on Monday. Quote, "I suggested that he, the president, temper his expectations. Those are my exact words. He can't bring them, coal, back," unquote. That's Bob Murray, a coal executive. So, And
he's
yes,
from
you're
Utah too, right?
Yeah, I think Arch. Yep. I don't know if it's Arch Coal, but yeah, he's a coal executive here in Utah. A lot of mining operations here in Utah. So, yes, and the president's planning to sign an executive order to kind of start the unraveling of the Clean Power Plan today, supposedly in the lobby of the EPA. And Scott Pruitt is actually inviting coal miners to join in on the signing of that executive order. It's astounding. The Environmental Protection Agency is going to be under Scott Pruitt will become the Environmental Pollution Agency. So, all right, a few more minutes. Nell, you have a question?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Clean Power Plan, and Chris, you got to.
I got to calm down.
Deep breath. But with relation to the Clean Power Plan, is that something that the Rainforest Action Network is going to be focusing on or weighing in on?
I mean, our focus right now is Keystone. At least the climate team is like very much like kind of gearing up to do a big push on the banks that are going to be funding Keystone, that are going to be funding TransCanada. We probably will put out some public communications on it in the next couple of days. In fact, I'm pretty sure we're preparing to do that. But we won't be doing any like a super big amount of campaign work on it right now. Groups like the Sierra Club are preparing to do that, et cetera.
Right.
And we're supportive of that, but our focus is going to be on Keystone and finance of Keystone and TransCanada.
Okay. Well, I got to ask, I mean, you're the Rainforest Action Network. How are things going within the rainforest? Because I've also read stories where the rainforests in Brazil continue to be harvested.
Right. Our big focus with rainforests is around Indonesia. We have multiple campaigns which work on the ground in Indonesia. And so palm oil, which is actually an additive in most foods in the United States, they cut down the rainforest in Indonesia to put up palm oil plantations. And then also a lot of the Indonesian rainforest is cut down for like paper products, which is put into a variety of packaging of items here in the United States. And so our sort of campaign work is on palm oil and paper in Indonesia. We have a lot of on-the-ground relationships with communities and local organizations in Indonesia. And that's also not the easiest political environment to operate in. It's actually fairly dangerous. But most of our rainforest work right now is like pretty focused on almost completely focused on Indonesia.
Right. Okay.
So if our listeners are interested in learning more about the Rainforest Action Network or getting involved in some of these campaigns, how should they do that?
They can go to our website at ran.org. We're also on Rainforest Action Network. It's also on Facebook and Twitter. We're very active on social media. I would encourage people to join our email list and get updates from us about the work that we're doing for both climate and forests.
All right.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Scott Parkin, for joining us today on This Green Earth.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Scott. All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, we got a little time for a couple calendar event, maybe a news item. Why not?
Sky's the limit.
You bet. It's This Green Earth.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
Right. Hey, welcome back to This Green Earth. It's a weekly talk show on environmental issues. We've got about 4 minutes.
4 minutes.
Okay. You got a number of things going on at Swanner.
We do.
Give me one.
Big week for us.
You get one.
I can't choose just one. All because right. We have on Thursday, Meet the Producers, which is an event about local and sustainable food. And we're putting that on in conjunction with our partners Recycle Utah and Eats. And that's all about meeting the folks that grow and raise and make food here locally. So you can make some sustainable options on that front.
Okay.
That is 5 to 7 p.m. this Thursday. It's free and open to the public.
It's
always a fun one.
Given a talk about moose.
Oh, we just had that.
Oh, how'd that go?
How did the moose cross the road, we called it. And that was in conjunction with the Sierra Club. We had Patty Kramer speaking about her research with wildlife crossings here in Utah. We packed the house. We more than packed the house. We had people standing by the doors.
Was I there?
Yeah, I missed you.
I think I was there. So that was great.
Really,
great turnout.
Really interesting stuff happening on that front with the
overpass. What was the takeaway? What did we learn? What did people have
a better understanding? We learned a lot about what different kinds of wildlife we'll use and won't use, some successes and failures here in the state. We talked about the upcoming overpass that'll take form near Parley's Summit, kind of between there and Lambs Canyon, and then the need for other connections across that I-80 corridor because the entire corridor is now fenced, right? And all that does is divide the animals onto these sides. So now they're struggling because they can't reach the winter or the summer habitat they need, the water source or the food source. And so that actually, you know, there's a decrease in mortality on the road, which is fantastic for human safety. But when we think about wildlife, this is not a sustainable solution. We need to find a way to get them across. So maybe there's an opportunity to do a couple of underpasses or overpasses across that I-80 corridor. So that was kind of where the conversation went toward the end.
So building a wall.
Of the night.
As we have it right now, and it's a bad idea.
Correct.
Like you say, it reduces the number of fatalities, but they want to move around.
They need to be able to reach different places at different times of year.
So overpasses, more overpasses than underpasses may be the idea here.
Right, that's ideal.
For all animals, like not just moose, elk, but elk, deer, bear.
Right.
Coyote,
mountain lions
are chasing the deer.
Even the smaller
the overpass.
You know, you want to have that connection between populations.
Okay, so there's an increasing need for that.
Yeah.
Right,
a lot of action on that front, I think. We'll
all right.
See.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's it.
That's it. That's the end.
Good job.
The end of the show.
Yeah, well, one last break, and then we do have to wrap up. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap up. Let's again thank our guests.
That's right. During the first half of the show, we spoke with Ashley Miller and Jenny Julander of Breathe Utah about air quality here in Utah, their upcoming Earth Day event, and a little bit of a recap of the legislative session. So thanks to them for that.
They're at breatheutah.org. And again, also thanks to Scott Park, and he's the Climate Campaign Director with the Rainforest Action Network. Filled us in on all things about the Keystone XL pipeline and other things that Rainforest Action Network is involved in. Visit their website to learn more about what they do. And of course, let's thank our underwriters who help make this show possible. They include
Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and Vail Epic Promise.
Vail Epic Promise and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain. Remember, you can email us your thoughts and comments at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.